Welcome to Talking Ideas. I'm your host, Rabia Malik. Talking Ideas is a podcast about Pakistan's economic and human development. It's housed at the Institute of Development and Economic Alternatives, or IDEAS for short. I work there as a research fellow. In this episode, we're looking at entrepreneurship in Pakistan. If you look at the technologies we use today, the internet, smartphones, social media, these are things that were created in places where big ideas have been rewarded with investment. Pakistan is witnessing a similar trend, where more and more young people are taking risks and attracting investment to start their own businesses. Often these startups are using technology to provide solutions to local problems. To understand this trend, we spoke to Fauzia Naqvi, who's a vice president at an impact investment fund in New York. She's been working for a long time on how to make high-impact investments in new Pakistani companies. We spoke to her about what entrepreneurship means for Pakistan.
There seems to be this artificial bifurcation between entrepreneurs and business and civil society. We don't connect the fact that entrepreneurship and this growing space of entrepreneurs is actually growing the space for civil society.
Here's our full conversation. Can you talk to us a little bit about what social entrepreneurship is and its significance for the development world?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to do this. I try not to make a differentiation between social entrepreneurship and entrepreneurship in general, because I think all entrepreneurship has a social benefit to the country in which the entrepreneurs are operating. But just for definition's sake, typically social entrepreneurs are assumed to be those who are filling a space in through private means that provide some sort of social benefits or social sector benefits to a particular segment of the population. And what do we mean by that? For instance, social entrepreneurs could provide clean water to a population that does not have access to the water. They could provide low-income housing that otherwise would not be available to a particular segment. The other differentiation, which when you say social entrepreneurship as opposed to entrepreneurship, is that there's an assumption in the larger public that these entrepreneurs are not out to make a profit. And therefore, it has all sorts of financial implications that we don't have to get into, but generally it is about providing a service, a social benefit to low-income populations, and often not-for-profit provision of those services. But I like to think of entrepreneurship as a wider umbrella under which there are many, many benefits that are provided if we foster entrepreneurship in a particular country.
Why is it so significant for contexts such as Pakistan, so not just Pakistan, but other developing countries as well, that private individuals are getting involved in service delivery in this way?
So what policymakers are often failing to see is if there's a growing number of young people getting involved in entrepreneurship, they're actually giving you a signal that they have confidence in their future in this country. And therefore, it is a very significant development in any country. You know, when we say entrepreneurs and when we say startups, what does it evoke? It evokes a bunch of very hip young people, and that is often true. But if you just stick to the young people, if somebody is giving up their very stable, cushy job in an institution, jumping ship and deciding to become an entrepreneur, that is an entirely risky proposition. One is that you're risking what in our societies is a no-no, which is failure. And two, you are giving up a steady stream of income. But what does it say on the other side? It says that you are betting on the future of the environment in which you are living. Now, entrepreneurs, you know, they may not even know that their business model is going to have a public benefit, because they're so focused on developing a business model developing the revenue model, fundraising. I mean, oftentimes they're working in what we in the industry call bootstrapping, right? So if you go to some of these businesses and you see where they're sitting and what they're producing, you'll be shocked. But those are the sacrifices these entrepreneurs are making. And sometimes they create the most phenomenal social benefit. And I, you know, if I may, I would like to just, you know, point to one or two entrepreneurs right here in Lahore. And, you know, my, as you've all heard me speak very much about Patari, which is, I guess you could define as a Spotify of Pakistan. And you'd think, okay, so how can that be a social benefit? Well, one, it is a collection of young people who have all left very cushy careers, and they've come together and taken this huge personal risk to start this company. And Patari is the largest online collection of Pakistani music, classic and new. The social benefit is that is they're trying to recapture what has been lost in this country. Okay, and that is music in the public space. What they are doing is they're bringing it all onto one platform, and their real hope is to once again build original Pakistani music. And that can have, as you know, multiple benefits, where young people are encouraged to go into the arts. Young people are encouraged to learn music and really feel that society appreciates that. So that's just one example of how startups and entrepreneurs actually can change the face of society.
Well, it's so fascinating to hear you talk about this, because one of the challenges that actually comes up so often in the discourse is Pakistan has a very young population, and one of the fears is that not enough jobs are being generated. So to hear that there are people who are creating jobs for themselves, who are creating work for themselves, and actually identifying gaps where services are needed, is very encouraging to hear that there is an environment that exists for them to work in. And I will come back to that question, actually. But another thing that I also wanted to speak about, when I look at some of the startups, or when you hear about some of the startups and the kind of work they're doing, there seems to be a lot of potential, actually. So where they identify and the type of work they're doing seems to be addressing a missing market or a missing mechanism for public service delivery. Would you say that a lot of these startups are doing work where the government has either yet not appeared or is missing in some way?
It's a little bit hard to say right now, because we have to kind of remember what the startups are doing. They're definitely resolving a pain point. Most of them are working on consumer-facing businesses. Most of them are technology-enabled as opposed to tech. We have to make that differentiation. Right? These are technology-enabled businesses. Are they ever going to substitute for the public sector? I don't think so, nor should they. What they should be able to do is be given space, okay, to build their own ecosystem and to build their own systems, right? The government is probably not going to be building e-commerce platforms. Correct? But what the government's responsibility to do is, and here it is happening, you know, we may not be connecting the dots, but it is happening, where, for instance, I know another startup in Lahore called Shopistan. Okay, so I don't know how many people know Shopistan, but they're a platform for retailers to build their online retail business. Okay, fantastically bootstrapped. Startup run by a young man named Ali Aziz, you know, absolutely gritty entrepreneur, building from scratch, and Shopistan is doing really, really well. So they are an e-commerce play, as we say. Now, in the future, you know, will he become a, you know, will he control the entire supply chain? He might. Will he perhaps need to control the supply chain, which includes logistics? He might. Will Shopistan be running its own trucks for delivery? They might. May they need their own warehouse to stock product from one of the retailers, because a retailer can't afford their own warehouse. So Shopistan may actually provide the warehouse from which things are then picked up and moved to another location, right? So what would he need from the government? he would need from the government to literally lay down the tracks, right? He would need the government to provide him infrastructure where his trucks could go from one end of this country to another without breaking down, without potholes. He would be looking for critical road and rail infrastructure by the government. And that's the job of both and equally, correct? Now, that said, you know, in the United States, what people, a lot of people don't know is that Silicon Valley would not have existed if it wasn't for monies coming in and innovations coming in from the Department of Defense. The R&D billions, right? So everything on your phone right now, the touch technology, GPRS, all the key functions that make your iPhone what it is and that make our social media and our this technology and that technology world what it is, has been funded by the US government, okay? And there are different issues there. What has happened is the taxpayer of the United States has taken all the early risk of building out these technologies that you and I are carrying in our hands. I, as an American citizen, have actually paid for that, right? And Silicon Valley entrepreneurs are earning millions of dollars off of what the taxpayer took as the early risk. Does the U.S. government or do the people of the United States regret that? I don't know. Probably not. But the issue does come out. Who took the early stage risk? Who built the railroad? And then who benefited and who made money off of it, correct? So these are questions societies must ask. But in a country like Pakistan, I don't think we are there where entrepreneurs are going to resolve key social sector issues. That should remain the purvey of the government. Something that is dear to your heart, which is education. What we are realizing is that the desire for private education amongst families, whether middle income or low income, is all pervasive, right? Unfortunately, parents would rather send their children to a mediocre private school than to even sometimes a good public school. Why? Because the perception of public schooling is so bad that people are not, if it's a shingle that says private school, English, whatever, they will send their child there. So the demand for private education is huge. So what entrepreneurs are going to do is they're going to respond to that demand. Now, we can debate endlessly the public policy of whether private education is better than public education. You know, I would submit that private education has its place and public education has its place. And public education is probably not going to be subsumed yet by private education. So we have a really huge job and moral duty to fix the public schooling system. But we also should provide space for affordable, high quality private education and make sure those private educators are accountable to the public that they are serving and to parents and to the students and to outcomes. And when we work with entrepreneurs, you know, we very much need to, especially when entrepreneurs are engaging in critical services like education or health or housing, we must absolutely hold them accountable because they're also going to be making profits out of that, right? So we really need to find that balance. But all to say is that in Pakistan right now, the good news is that there's so much room for everybody to play their role. And if I may, the something that's very, very important for me and a point that I have been mulling over for several years now is that from market to market, from investor to investor, donor to donor, there seems to be this artificial bifurcation between entrepreneurs and business and civil society. That entrepreneurs somehow get tossed into the basket of for-profit private sector business, which they are, and they are never included or seen as civil society. Although this entrepreneur may go to their office in the morning and be sitting with you or standing with you in a protest in the evening, and yet we don't connect the fact that entrepreneurship and this growing space of entrepreneurs is actually growing the space for civil society, and that we need to include them in those civic engagements, correct? And we need to broaden the base of civil society because they are contributing to civic engagement. They're contributing to civil society in ways that we're not even aware of, especially those of us who seem to claim the civil society space, right? And from the needs of entrepreneurs emerge so many civic spaces and the need for civic spaces that I think it's hard to even quantify at this point. But the mindset about private business and entrepreneurs needs to shift in order for them to really be successful in a country like Pakistan.
Well, that's really, really interesting, actually. And yesterday you were speaking to us. So in addition to everything that you've mentioned right now, one of the things that you were, one of the other startups that you were talking to us about was the microinsurance startup and how it's actually reaching out to women and getting, so such a almost a basic benefit, a basic social benefit and a safety net for risks that a very large proportion of this population is exposed to, whether it's accidents at workplaces, whether it's accidents on the road, whether it's, you know, and we're talking about a context where there's usually a single bread earner for the family, and it's usually a male. So the kind of risks that they're exposed to, and, you know, in the very unfortunate instances where something happens and you no longer have, you know, the breadwinner with you anymore. Can you talk to us a little bit about how, whether there's potential for social entrepreneurship to open up spaces, whether it's public spaces for women, whether it's sort of access to kind of services that they didn't have before, whether it's access to the kind of jobs they didn't have before. Can you speak to us a little bit about that?
Yes, I can. I mean, without specifically naming the company, insurance is very much part of financial inclusion for those who are outside of the formal financial system. And what insurance really is a financial safety net under people who, with one health shock or one accident, are thrown into abject poverty and usually lose their sole income generator. And aside from the trauma of somebody being harmed or losing somebody, their lives actually go into a tailspin that it's very hard to come out of unless they have that financial safety net beneath them. So that is what, you know, personal accident insurance provides, or health insurance actually provides, and how significant it is for low-income populations. The trick obviously there is to price in a way that is affordable. And the other thing is to be able to explain to the customer why it's important. It has these benefits on the gender angle that you wouldn't otherwise think. For instance, in this country, having a national ID card is like having oxygen. Without the national ID card, you simply cannot do anything. You do not have an identity. You don't have a financial identity. You can't enter a building. You can't drive down the street. You can't get social benefits. And guess what? You cannot vote. And that's a horrifying thought in a country where it's one person, one vote. So if women don't have national ID cards, they don't exist, right? To the great credit of Pakistan, that is an issue that is a front and center from a public policy issue. And the Benazir Income Support Program has really been at the forefront of this benefit, where woman is considered the head of household and is a recipient of the monthly check and has to have a national ID card. Okay. But then there are people who are outside of BISB, or BISB hasn't reached. And I spent a couple of days actually having the privilege of coming across men and women in the low income segment who were clients of this insurance company. And the whole conversation about national ID cards and the importance of that with women was really phenomenal. You know, there were some men who were telling me how it was not important for the women to have an ID card because what would they ever need it for, right? And then to explain to them what it actually does for them. Or something like a mobile phone. Why would my daughter need a mobile phone? And to explain to them that phones are not just for talking, but actually they are service providers and they are products and services that you can avail for your life in case something happens, right? So you could see kind of the the attributes that come out of what seems like a technical product called insurance, and we all roll our eyes and say, oh, you know, actuaries are so boring, what do we want to do with this? But when you really implement it and see how it impacts everyday lives, and the gender angle in this country of something like a financial safety net and women being the recipient and the beneficiary of that, you know, it's just hard to quantify if you get it right. And I think Pakistan, you know, is one country where we need to measure progress in increments. We are not going to see it in just leaps and bounds, right? We're going to see some things in leaps and bounds, but we're not going to see these fundamental, you know, again, building the railroad kind of changes in leaps and bounds. We will have to track it and plot it, and you all understand that being economists, you know, as if the trajectory is right, but unfortunately it's going to be incremental. And because I've been a Pakistan watcher for many, many years, you know, I can plot the incremental changes. And I think that for the most part, those are, you know, tracking in the right direction. And in this particular visit to Pakistan, you know, with the range of people I've met, and particularly spending so much time with entrepreneurs of all shades and hues, I would say that it's tracking in the right direction. However, I have to use this opportunity to say to our policymakers and to our corporate sector big boys and girls that you are failing. You're failing the youth in fundamental ways. And I would say those young people who want to be entrepreneurs, who are giving you the gift of their hard work, their foregoing income, betting on the future of this country despite everything our generation has done to fail them, you are once again failing them by not paying attention to building an ecosystem around this around these entrepreneurs that actually make life easier for them. I particularly point to big corporations that seem to get engaged with entrepreneurs with an attitude of we will own you, and how stifling that is and how difficult that makes it for these entrepreneurs to actually succeed. But despite that, they are succeeding, right? So that shows you the potential of these people. But it, you know, for instance, payments platforms, right, which is a huge part of financial inclusion. The regulations in Pakistan are completely some of the best in the world. There's no two ways about it. And I would really tip my hat to the regulators and to the State Bank of Pakistan for, you know, in 2008, writing the branchless banking regulations. But I think they need to now pay attention to the new world. They need to pay attention to how, you know, entrepreneurs are trying to build tech-enabled businesses, and particularly what we are calling fintech, right? Financial inclusion using technology. We need to come around the table and be more imaginative and be more innovative in providing payment systems that are not dependent entirely on the telecom systems and airtime, and just think a little bit more broadly about, for instance, if I were to go and buy a product, you know, is my online or work, you know, how do I actually broaden distribution systems, and how do I not be so solely dependent on one industry in order to make the whole system move. I think all players have had a very, you know, hugely positive role, but I think we're at this kind of moment where we're kind of stuck. And I think the telecoms are doing what they need to do, but I think this comes a moment where the monopolies and the giants have to understand that even they will not go further unless they concede a little bit of space to everybody else. And a society only grows if you know, multiple pieces of it are able to grow and breathe. And so we're kind of in that inflection point where the entrepreneurs in this country will be permitted to breathe and flourish, or they will be kept in this kind of very, very, very difficult, slow burn environment, and many will lose hope and move on to doing what they used to do. I think my bet is that if this country is going, the inflection point will show that we are going to become a really vibrant, humming ecosystem, but I think we're not there yet, and there's real risk that the what I call the big boys and girls are not going to let the ecosystem flourish the way that it needs to. So those are some of the things that I've noticed in this country that, you know, need to change, but are also very positive changes. And you're thinking to yourself, well, this is all great, Fawzia, but how does it impact, you know, how does this impact the price of peas for real households? Well, what hopefully entrepreneurs are doing is that they're saying, okay, almost every economic segment has one thing in common across the board, and they've got this thing in their hands. Everybody's walking around with this thing called a smartphone or a BlackBerry that is also allowing you to do somewhat similar. So what do we do with that? And how do we make their lives easier by being able to provide essential products and services right at their doorstep or right at their hands, right? So, I mean, you've heard these stories before. Every country in the world is talking about smartphones and how do you do that. In Pakistan, they're doing that too. This will hopefully impact in a good way, in a healthy way, the way society functions, the fact that, you know, you and the gentleman who may be driving you around is equalized in a way that you may not even have imagined, that while you are, you know, busy transacting and paying your bill, you know, he or she too is sitting there paying their bill the same way that you're paying your bill. He or she may also be now a client of a financial institution that you are also a client of. And those banks that wouldn't allow him or her through the front doors because of the way they looked or didn't look now, right, now are forced to accept them as clients because they have this technology and, you know, are able to transact and are linked up in a way that were never linked up. So technology can also be a great equalizer. And I think the first step to development in a society, we cannot talk about economic justice or economic advancement or economic development unless we talk about what we would like to call the first order rights, right? If citizens of the country do not have equal citizenship rights, it doesn't matter how much development you do or whether CPEC is going from here to there. If there are entire communities and income segments in this country that are not treated as equal citizens, then that is a huge problem. This, I think, is the benefit of what these entrepreneurs are doing. They're equalizing, right? They are leveling the playing field, and they're telling every Pakistani, you know, we can provide you the same product or the same services. And oh, by the way, it doesn't matter which income level you're coming from, yeah? If it's affordable, and they have to make it affordable, because otherwise their businesses wouldn't work. What I can see as an observer is that is what is going on in Pakistan. And that is fantastic. When I went around introducing myself to entrepreneurs and asking them their names, I couldn't recognize any of the last names. And that was a very good sign. And I asked them, what do your parents do? And that was also a very good sign. These were all people who had come from very different backgrounds. Some were from very wealthy backgrounds, some were from middle-income backgrounds, some were from low-income backgrounds. But they all had what they had in common was they had all achieved a certain level of education. They had worked in companies, and they had decided to jump and do their own thing. But they were definitely not from the same socioeconomic background. They weren't the elite capture that we see and that I saw when I was, you know, growing up in this country. They seem to be breaking through that, because you really don't need to, or rather, your dad's name can help you only so far in making this work, right? Ultimately, it's going to be your ability to have grit and bootstrap, right? Because what do you have to do? You have to do the dance in front of investors. Beyond friends and family money, you're going to have to be out there competing with everybody else to raise seed money or growth capital. And that's where it's going to be really the rubber will meet the road. And that was one of the most positive signs that I saw of who these entrepreneurs were. And they were coming from such diverse backgrounds. And I think that is, again, an incremental signal of how through entrepreneurship we can see social and economic change in a way that we never thought we would see before.
Oh, I think that's fantastic, actually. And one of the questions that, in fact, two or three of the questions that you sort of addressed yourself. So you spoke about sort of equality of access and equality in the services. But the other dimension that we were really hoping to bring out also is the equality of opportunity in generating the kinds of businesses that you can start and what you can do.
You know, I'm not sure yet of that this is going to be a tremendous job creation.
Okay.
Phenomena, because remember the flip side of tech enabled and technology is the future of work,
right?
Which means that the more technology you use, the less people you're going to use. But what we are seeing is that people who were not occupying the labor market or were not occupying public space are now there, and I really mean women, and I mean people coming from not from the upper echelons of society who, you know, who daddy calls and says, you know, give my son a job. That's breaking down. So for instance, you know, I don't want to romanticize call centers, but the fact is that what I witnessed was that 60 to 70% of the employees of the call center were women, and the backgrounds that they were coming from, and the confidence that was giving to them. These tech-enabled companies are also providing opportunities for young people, graphic designers, video designers, web designers, you know, people who know their way around technology. They're being hired. Pakistan is right now one of the fastest growing, freelancing, technology freelancing market, where people are making money hand over fist sitting inside their own homes. These are women and men. So, is it having a really fundamental impact upon labor markets, in the demographics, in who's in them, what are they earning, what are they doing? It's providing opportunities, even short-term work, right? People, the idea of work as a stable, you know, you're going to work for 10 years in a company, you know, our parents may have a problem with that, but this new generation is saying, well, you know what, I'm going to work 6 months and earn this much, and then I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this. And I think, again, it's choices that this new generation has that we didn't have, right? We only had few routes to go into. And I think that provided we keep nurturing the good in this and don't put up barriers and don't make it a bad thing, I think there is a fundamental shift in the way that people are thinking about employment. And I think those are all great things to track. And I think they're great things to celebrate. And in Pakistan, we have so few reasons to take victory laps. I think we should take victory laps and move on to the next thing.
This was fantastic. Thank you so very much for a fascinating conversation.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Talking Ideas. In the next episode, Ideas director Faisal Bari sits down with two researchers who found that giving citizens an online platform to rank government employees improved public service delivery in Punjab. Thanks for listening.